Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host,
McGill.
McGill is here. I am here. It is the 17th of November, 2020. Getting towards the end of the year, at last.
And the year that never ends.
Yeah, pretty much. We're finally spiraling towards the end there. And for me, it is the start of a new act. In case you don't know what we do on this podcast, we recount tales of RPGs we've run in the past and try to glean some advice that we can share with other prospective DMs and whatnot.
And, I kind of hate to think of the listeners who tune in like at this point and don't go back and listen to everything that came before.
What would be episode 38, my session 37? Yeah, well, I just feel like I haven't done the rundown in a while, so might as well. What I have is the start of a new act in my campaign, the second last, the penultimate act in my campaign. It will begin with Operation Inner Lighthouse, in which MPOC's finest will return to the city of Austin, the northern capital. So they visited in the past, but never in a non-military context. And this time they are there as visitors in the city. There won't be such a pressing urgency as there has been in the past. What have you got for us, McGill, in your Verdant Apocalypse Chapter 7?
When we last left our heroes, they had come upon a strange kind of anomaly, I guess you could call it, where part of the city had basically disappeared and replaced by thick jungle foliage. And as they drove their like lowrider El Camino half track vehicle into the jungle, they came upon a dinosaur. What? So more craziness involving that stuff.
It's a dinosaur. It's a. I never liked that one as much as Superman. Superman. He is the man. He is Superman. as far as you know, little songs to remember the theme tunes to certain movies.
I think that's actually intentional. You know. I remember, not to go off on too big of a tangent, but I listened to an episode of Kevin Smith's podcast, Fat Man on Batman, and in the early days of that podcast, when I still listened to it, all he would do is just interview people associated with different Batman properties, and he interviewed a guy who would do music for a lot of the Batman animated straight-to-DVD movies, and that composer, whose name escapes me, talks about how he would always compose with that kind of thing in mind. He had done the music for a Green Lantern animated movie, and the beats to the theme would match up with the oath of the Green Lanterns, you know, in Blackest Day and in Brightest Day and Blackest Night, no evil will escape my sight. And so the theme would go like da 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 da, so you could kind of sing along with it. So I think that's a thing, Tom. I think it is.
Well, I think, there's definitely, I think it's actually a deleted scene from a movie that the guys from Nirvana, the band, the show worked on, but they have a scene where a guy is teaching a music class and is doing like, you know, like when you hear the Jurassic Park theme, it's a dinosaur, it's a dinosaur, and the kids are all just kind of like staring at him blankly, like, you know, it's a high school, they don't want to be there.
Anyways, Brett Domino also does something similar where he just puts lyrics to the whole thing. Tyrannosaurus is my favorite dinosaur,
right, et cetera. It's been a while. Anyways, that is a tangent, but it all started with dinosaurs because of Verdant Apocalypse. We're going into... Do you ever watch that old cartoon, Cadillacs and Dinosaurs?
Oh, heck yeah. I'm a huge fan. I like to Cadillacs double bill Cadillacs and dinosaurs with Dino Riders.
I think it actually used to play before Calamity Jane on Teletoon. Anyway, little reveries today. Maybe that's what's going to be the theme. I'll tell you what else is for mine, actually. I mean, for me, the theme is revisiting things, but we'll get to that. Speaking of, last time I think I made you go first so that I would have most of the runway because I had a lot of stuff going on. Should I go first this time?
Yeah, you take it away.
So Operation Inner Lighthouse. Where to begin? I mean, the MPOX finest. They just basically saved Princess Remy of Goblin Town and also Goblin Town itself by driving out the Nightside Eclipse and their machinations from that city. They managed to score a Zeppelin in the process. And their next mission saw them headed towards Austin, the capital in the north, which is primarily a human city, but historically it is a city. It's like the city represents the collaboration or the alliance between humanity and dwarves historically in the north. It's always been sort of a human dwarf city. But as I've alluded to a bit previously and in previous episodes, the last two times that MPOX Finest came to Austin were both during times of like major military crisis. The first time was when the orcs were raging out of control because of a sort of tactical misstep on the part of the MPOC, although they couldn't know that the leader of the orcs had been replaced with a doppelganger. But that led to a large orc army raging out of control in the north, which almost destroyed Austin, but MPOC's finest managed to sort of head off the orc charge before it could come to completion with a little black ops that Austin didn't actually know about at the time. Then, the next time, MPOX Finest had just chased some Nightside Eclipse operatives out of hell and had found themselves in the area of Austin, and this was when they first encountered the Cannabis Corps enemies that the Nightside Eclipse had been working on. That ended with the Cannabis Corpses and the Minotaur Skeletons and those Nightside Eclipse operatives. They launched a full assault on the city of Austin, which the MPOX Finest caught up with them because they were hot on their heels and were able to defeat the leadership. But by that point, about half the city had already been very handily destroyed by big Minotaur skeletons and these Cannabis Corps things and the foul magics of the leaders of the Nightside Eclipse forces. So this third time that we are coming to Austin, it is very much a city in a period of reconstruction. It is also a city that, while I said that it's sort of a dwarven human city, the dwarves have effectively given up on it at this point, or they're keeping their distance. Their capital, Artin, has proven much more safe than Austin, and Artin is a much more, you know, dwarven city. Like, it's, you know, located in a mountain and all that stuff. It's their ancestral home, and so the dwarves have largely vacated Austin, and we are coming back to Austin as sort of a hopeful project of human reconstruction. Like, we may have lost just about everything we had to all these orc assaults and then these undead assaults, but we can still rebuild, and Austin is now sort of the testament to that. And the reason why MPOX Finest are being sent to Austin at this particular juncture is because Dwarven Alliance Day is coming up in Austin. Basically, the celebration of the alliance that Austin has always been meant to represent is coming up, and this is going to be a big time for it because it's going to be one where, you know, if things continue to go badly, it's likely that this Dwarven Human Alliance won't mean anything for Austin and that will all fall through. So there's a vested interest for stability in the area in making sure that the ceremonies for the Dwarven Alliance Day go off without like calamity this time around, because then it's like, don't worry, it's safe, and the MPOC is sort of investing in it to make sure, like, you know, the ceremonies this time will mean more than they've ever meant before. But
how do what kind of celebrations are in store for Dwarven Alliance Day?
There's basically sort of banquets, big fest hall, or really not fest hall dances, but like you know, there's big promenades and plazas in the city, and so like big parties out in these areas. You'll have like traditional dwarven music, and they'll like dwarves will come from Arten en masse, and they'll be selling their wares and you know, authentic dwarven brews and whatnot. And it's sort of like a mingling of the two cultures where they both sort of show off their best, to each other. And, you know, sort of contests, feats of strength, that sort of thing. All the sort of things that you can expect from, you know, party games of the ancient times. But, of course, this makes, you know, with the gravity of this event underlined this particular time, this makes it kind of a bullseye for anyone who is looking to destabilize the area. And what is interesting is that while the MPOC's finest have been deployed, our heroes have been deployed to Austin, you know, to make sure this goes smoothly. They are obviously prepared in case the Nightside Eclipse tries to pull something, but I can tell you that actually in this act, the Nightside Eclipse is not involved in what is going on in Austin. So in that sense, I'm sort of changing gears and, like, you know, showing the MPOC again, just like, it's something I've done in the past, like the Screech Owls situation had nothing to do with the Nightside Eclipse generally. And so it's like, you know, the MPOC, while they are focused on fighting the Nightside Eclipse, sometimes they play the long game by just trying to provide stability for Drail so that it does not fall victim to the Nightside Eclipse easily. So there's basically, you know, the players don't know this going in, but there's basically two situations going on. One is that there is corruption in the leadership of Austin. And this, while this isn't really the major threat to Austin, it is one that will kind of make things a bit hazy for the MPOC's finest as they try to sort through what is going on. The other issue is that there are terrorists who are basically, their goal, they're a group of elven archmagi from the area of Settlers Green, which has always been historically oppressed by the Dwarven Human Alliance, at least to some extent. Basically, the history of this is that there was a war in the north between elves, humans, and dwarves. Humans and dwarves teamed up and beat the elves, and then that's how things ended up. So the elves have always been sort of pulled the short stick in terms of development of Austin and its history. But generally what has been going on in the setting, in the background that I've been setting up, is that currently there's a new faction in Settlers Green called the Free Circle. I mentioned previously that Alistair, the warlock, entered a romantic relationship with an NPC that was a cleric by the name of Ariel. Ariel is actually a member of the Free Circle. It's basically just sort of a union of groups or individuals in Settlers Green trying to look out for each other. And then meanwhile, these elven archmagi terrorists are taking a much more militant stance against Austin, and what they are trying to do is spark a war between Austin and Settlers Green. Even though they do not represent the Free Circle, they would like Austin to think that the Free Circle is a military threat and, lead to open conflict between the two organizations.
Ah, this is kind of like that Princess Bride scenario that I referenced on a previous episode.
I was thinking that. It's funny you said that, and I was like, well, that will happen very soon, but not then when you said it. But yeah, now we're coming to that point.
Huh.
Cool. So in Operation Inner Lighthouse, it is largely just the introduction to Austin, the city as it's been reconstructed. This was a neat one where I had basically a small map that just had sort of like the main key areas that they would need to visit, like the city hall, the main civic promenade that I mentioned. And then there's a major nightclub called the Prancing Pony, which is a reference to Lord of the Rings. But also, for a lot of these things, like I mentioned, like the Barking Dog Inn was established as the new MPOC base in the last episode in Goblin Town. All of these inn names or location names like that are basically, I think it's in the Dungeon Master's Guide, there's a list of like, you know, one column and then another column, and it was like, just mix and match these to make up, you know, inn names or whatever have you. But the columns line up to make very like obvious connections. Like Prancing Pony is literally lined up between the two columns as if they're just like, huh? Huh? Lord of the Rings? Wink? Like, you know. So I just sort of went with that, and I went through the list just like line by line, like the two columns together like that, and just took all of those names and like assigned those to different establishments all over Drail. So the Prancing Pony is sort of like the high end spot in Austin. And another place that they ended up visiting, so I'm getting ahead of myself. So I have this map of the city that has these key points, but when they arrive, one thing is that I had previously mentioned in the last time that they visited Austin, they made a contact named Arn, who basically has become an MPOC agent, and he is now sort of the MPOC liaison with Austin. So when they arrive, they immediately have an MPOC contact who's like, okay, well, here's the situation that's going on right now. And when they arrive, they have arrived at a point where there is a prisoner who is slated to be executed, supposedly for some like smuggling and conspiracy against the city. However, there's something fishy about it. And I can say as DM that what's going on is that this prisoner is just like a patsy. There is corruption, as I mentioned, in the upper lords of Austin, and one Lord Hart has been running a sort of smuggling operation that, because of the terrorist threat now, he very quickly needs to like separate himself from, like, well, I don't have anything to do with any of this criminal activity, so I can't be involved with this. And so he lays the guilt all on this patsy, who is now a prisoner who the MPOC go to sort of interview to find out what is going on, because they are thinking, okay, well, this guy may have something to do, or he may know something about how these terrorists are going to be operating or getting into the city, or he may have been even doing smuggling work in collusion with them. That is effectively what he is being charged with and, sentenced to execution for. And it's interesting. This is a very different operation than any other ones that I've done, certainly in this campaign that I've been talking about. It was basically sort of, they toured around the city and they did investigation. It was a lot of like interviewing witnesses and stuff. So they spoke with the prisoner And while they did sort of order his execution be stayed, they did not determine his innocence either. It's interesting. Like, do you have a lot of experience with this kind of like quest or adventure?
Like an investigation kind of a thing, you mean?
I guess, but something where it's specifically, it's not like there's a crime scene with clues. It's more going around and like interviewing different people.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I can't think of an immediate example, but I've definitely done... It's essentially sort of like an elaborate game of Clue almost. Or I think of like the movie Sleepy Hollow, where Ichabod Crane is interviewing everybody in the town and sort of piecing together a grander picture based on their stories, and also in doing so finding inconsistencies. I've definitely run adventures like that, that are like, they are investigations in that you use a lot of like sense motive checks, a lot of wisdom based checks, and the investigate skill as well.
So I guess the follow-up question then is, when you've done these adventures, see, what's interesting to me about this operation is that they effectively did not solve, like, they didn't figure this out. They did not figure out that Lord Hart was the one behind the corruption. They suspected something was up to the extent that they were like, well, I don't know that we should execute this guy. This guy might be important later. Like, they didn't stay the execution because they thought he was innocent, but they thought that the prisoner's testimony could be valuable. But they did not actually solve what was going on. And what was interesting about this is, it's kind of like you mentioned the thing about the Ichabod Crane, is that this was almost, it's like this was the hook for the operation, but the actual function of the operation in the act was to just sort of introduce them to the city, really. Like, so they spoke to this prisoner, and then they'd get different leads, like different names that they could follow up with. And then they went out into the city and went to these different places. And one of the specific places they ended up going to was a brothel called the Running Stag, which was another one of these establishments, you know, named basically by like two things that were right next to each other in the DMG. And so they go to this brothel, the Running Stag, and they meet the madam, who is a goblin. And they eventually figured out that the actual owner of the Running Stag was an archmage by the name of Ali. So had kind of like a Kalim Shan is the Forgotten Realm setting, but, you know, kind of like an Arabian Nights kind of vibe to him. And, you know, so there was a lot of sort of like getting to know the different sort of underworld figures in the city, speaking to different lords and stuff, but there was no resolution in terms of like, okay, like we know what happened here. It was more just like set up so that as their investigation with the terrorist plot continued, they would have like some entry points. Do you have any like insight on something like that, or like, does that, any questions?
No questions, but actually building off of what you were saying, because I think you were going to ask me this even if the question never fully formed, but like, did my players actually figure out what was going on?
I mean, I got the sense that you'd done this more than once, but like, yeah, it depends. Like,
well, I don't think they have ever successfully pieced together the whole puzzle.
It calls to mind when you were doing Minds of Metal and Wheels Part 2, there was a time when they just went around and started doing like investigation. Like, there was a lot of follow up with the Jack the Ripper situation.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a case. That's probably where they got the clearest picture of like a full investigation that they had done. But also something I've talked about on a previous episode is the adventure module, Is There an Elf in the House, where the players get trapped at an inn because of a blizzard, and there's a haunting and a ghost. People start getting murdered, and eventually they discover that there's like a witch in the basement who's trying to conduct a ceremony. Usually, the Jack the Ripper one was just sort of straight up investigation, but usually when I run that type of adventure, I do what Is There an Elf in the House does, where there are timed events as well, so that if the players get stuck and they fail a bunch of their like sense motive checks or something, or they just can't seem to figure out the clues, there's always something that's going to happen to keep driving the plot forward regardless of their actions. But oftentimes, no. I don't know if there's ever been a single time where like they've figured out every detail of the full intrigue, as it were.
I guess it's also interesting to note that in the case of this Operation Inner Lighthouse, like even though they are investigating what I know is basically a case of internal corruption in the city, that like as characters, that is not really the thing that they are concerned with. Like it's something that is, you know, causing a problem because they have to investigate it as if it is one of their main concerns just in case. But their real concern is this terrorist plot, which this is actually not connected to. It's kind of a red herring. And so it's interesting to me because I don't think I run operations like this very often at all. And this one time that I did run an operation like this, it was almost like the operation was just a framing device to serve a narrative function, which was like, hey, welcome to Austin. This is the city you're going to be doing your next few operations in. And like, there's stuff going down here, so familiarize yourself with it. On that note, there were a few things that happened while they were in the city. One thing is there was a random encounter I rolled where a goblin pickpocket, a hapless goblin pickpocket, attempted to pickpocket these. They would have been level 18 at this point. Level 18 characters. And in retribution, I think Valfar was the guy who had the spell. He cast, one we've talked about before, Feeble Mind on this goblin pickpocket. So a goblin tried to pickpocket some very high-level heroes while they were going through the city of Austin and ended up just, like, completely stupefied. That is not where that story ends. We will revisit that later.
Oh, interesting. Does your campaign, hitherto unmentioned, have a nemesis system like Lord of the Rings, Shadows over Mordor, or whichever?
It's not necessarily that, but I feel like something like that, it's like if a character spends a high level spell slot to do something really debilitating to just like a random encounter dude, like and they don't like actually take that character out, I'm like, well, that element's still there in the city then.
Remind me again, what's Valfar's class?
Bard.
A bard. Okay, I was gonna say he's a paladin. I mean, come on, man. That's
Magnus is the paladin, right? Which, in fairness, Magnus is a paladin devoted to Garador, the blind god of destruction, and he's a vengeance paladin, and he's an alcoholic. Meanwhile, Valfar is like a black dragonborn, black metal bard. So they're actually pretty, you know. Magnus is very much on the sort of cantankerous side of things. And
it's in character if they're murder hobos.
Well, Valfar is just kind of like sinister. He's like kind of, I guess you'd call him an anti-hero. So that was one thing that happened, is a goblin tried to pickpocket them and got hit with like a super debilitating spell. But then I was like, okay, there's a goblin pickpocket wandering around with like barely any sentience in the city now. The other thing is that they visited the Running Stag brothel in their investigation. And speaking of like the characters being a little short on the moral spectrum. Alistair, who I just earlier explained is in a relationship with a woman from the Free Circle, actually decided to purchase services from the brothel, which Mealy noted was like, hey, you were in a relationship with that girl. And he's like, basically like, shh, we're on a mission. And then Alistair later, like in the next session, it may have actually been that Alistair couldn't make it to the next session, but I did like a downtime thing for him. So it may have been like, this was what was happening. And I think I had a scene where he basically had to like, I think what he did was he rolled deception against Ariel, the woman he was in the relationship with. But then Mealy was like, well, fuck that. I'm going to tell her that you cheated on her, which is like very funny for me as a dungeon master, is like this player is trying to like just fuck around consequence free, classic D&D stuff. And then another player is like, you can't do that. And it was very nice to have that sort of like karmic enforcement without me putting my thumb on the scale or anything.
That's full on role playing.
Yeah,
Ariel, the girl that he is in a relationship with, did you have her like tag along at all as a party NPC, or was it a long distance relationship the whole time?
It's the idea is basically that, and I'm pretty sure that she actually leaves. Like, this stops being the case by the end of this act, but I believe that Ariel or the way I had set up Ariel once she was introduced was that she eventually joined the MPOC and became like their apothecary, or like not their apothecary, they have that's a guy named Wenton. She became their like in-house cleric healer, healing services provider. So it was something where, you know, they saw her every time they went back to base, that sort of thing. But on that note, like, I think actually because this relationship did eventually disintegrate because of Valfar's indiscretions and, Mealy's desire to, you know, see him brought to justice, Ariel did eventually leave the services of the MPOC. Although I think that was also sort of a political move, because, at that point, it seemed like the Free Circle and the MPOC were going to be at odds on a factional level. But that is all sort of that's sort of the last we hear about Ariel, basically, is like she was with the MPOC briefly. Alistair fucks around. I have real trouble with these guys' names. Valfar is the bard. Alistair is the warlock. Magnus is the paladin. Mealy is the rogue. All this to say, they like, you know, it was very much sort of a explore the city, talk to witnesses, get to know the ins and outs of the city, like who, you know, who is the guy who runs the brothel, who's like the underworld guy, it's this archmage and stuff, like figuring that out, who getting the information from Ada, the goblin madam of the place, that she actually worked for the owner, who was this archmage. Like, that was all sort of key information, especially for like making contacts in the city and being able to draw on those contacts when, you know, it came time to act against the terrorists. The only other thing I was going to say about this session is that at the start of the act, at this point I was basically doing this each act, the players would level up. So they've gone from level 17 to 18. And I introduced another weapon to the armory, which in this case was the Hephaestus Military, which is basically like a combat shotgun, like a six shot, trench gun sort of thing or what have you.
They're tricked out.
Yep. That was another thing, actually, is like around the city there were various merchants and each one had like a special magic item for sale if they like visited each of the different spots. And because they might visit different spots on different operations, it was like, you know, it was kind of scattered around for them to find.
Here's a question for you, actually, about how you, the DM, handled the investigative nature of this particular mission, because it sounds like it was fairly low combat, right?
Yes, very.
So did you fill in that time, because combat eats up a lot of time, did you fill in that time by doing more elaborate like role-playing interactions? Because that was something that I always sort of have in mind if I'm running one of these adventures that's kind of based around investigating, is just giving each NPC that they talk to a more distinct persona, a funny accent, just something to make them stand out from the rest so that they can sort of keep them in their mind and be like, oh, wait, but remember the guy with the bad Scottish accent said this, and that's inconsistent with this guy who's a hunchback, that kind of thing. Did you do a lot of like in-character NPC role playing for it?
I did have each sort of witness character they spoke to in mind. Like I knew, okay, there was going to be the Goblin Madam. There was going to be the sort of like Ali, the sort of Arabian Nights Archmage with the turban. There would be the different lords, and like the corrupt one is sort of like, ooh, yes, and all that. And you know, the desperate prisoner who is like basically on death row for something he didn't do. That was all there. I think the other thing, though, was like what I really leaned into was fleshing out like the city and the various locations. And like I did have like so that pickpocket encounter could have been a combat. It ended up just being like one spell and then it was done. But yeah, it was something where I think instead of combat, I knew that I would have time to have them visit a lot more locations and have each location have at least one character. But like in a lot of cases, like three, like the brothel and whatnot, you know, it was something where I planned out these locations, like the Prancing Pony, the Running Stag, the Promenade, the City Hall, the dungeons, and which characters would be in there. And then I just knew like, okay, well, however much time they need for this investigation, we've got all the time in this session to just like visit all of these places, go back and forth between them, talk to different people, that sort of thing.
Nice. That's fun. They're always fun. Gives the DM a chance to put on a lot of different hats.
Yeah, I think the answer is kind of like yes, but there was a real emphasis on like introducing the city more than just the characters.
Right.
Because I'd be continuing to use this same location for the next few ops. So, meanwhile, in the Vernon Apocalypse...
Open the door, get on the floor, everybody walk the dinosaur. It ended on a big note. As I said, suddenly they find themselves like in this thick jungle environment, and Brachiosaurus crashes by in front of them. I guess it is almost like the Jurassic Park thing where the first dinosaur is a Brachiosaurus, but I wanted to make their first encounter with a dinosaur a peaceful one where they're just sort of surprised by the fact that there's a dinosaur there. I didn't want them to immediately run into something like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I suppose now is a good time to sort of tip my hand and tell you a bit of what's really going on here. Do you have any guesses, Tom?
Is this like what's going on in the whole setting in general.
Yeah. Because you guessed a dinosaur. You guessed that that's what was going to happen.
Yeah, that's just because that'd be the coolest thing to have it be in the jungle. You know, see, I just want it to be my idea where the start of this campaign was actually like right after the climax of a campaign that they can't remember. And they're going to find out that they actually like had already been on this crazy adventure and they almost completed it.
It's a great idea. That's not quite what happened. But, you know, it very easily the cause of this situation that led to this weird verdant apocalypse could easily have been a different group of adventurers at some point screwed everything up. But no, that's not quite what's going on.
They just had their minds wiped.
could be, I suppose. So, hey, I'm going to use a really loaded word.
Oh, I know.
Let's have it.
Some kids are playing Jumanji.
Man, I should have done it. I should have had them find a weird board game and not know what to make of it. And
like a group of like savage kids who like are protecting it like it's a sacred thing. And like they make them play. Oh, my God. That'd be
Lord of the Flies meets Jumanji. I kind of love that. But no, as I said, I'm going to use a word that has a bit of a loaded meaning on this show. The answer, my friend.
Man, that's the second amazing sequel idea I've had on this show. There's the Men in Black one where the criminal gets the neuralizer and just goes around like ruining the world with that. But then like kids who find the Jumanji board and realize that it influences reality. So then they use it to like become gods. That'd be amazing.
It's pretty dope, I have to say. Write that one down, folks. I guess we have it on record here.
Children of the Jumanji.
Children of the Jumanji. Lord of the Manji. I keep teasing it. Tom, what's the loaded word I'm about to use?
It
starts with an R.
Like, retcon?
No. Rifts. The answer.
Oh, Rifts. Classic. Rifts. Love me some Rifts.
But of course, not Rifts, the RPG. But I didn't actually like completely write
it's
out.
It's funny because I actually wanted to say when you said they went into the jungle, like, oh, this is just like Rifts. Like the whole thing in Rifts is that between the cities, there's now just like complete wilderness and you need like survival gear to move from settlement to settlement.
So it's not quite that, and I didn't write out all the specifics of it because, for one thing, they're not totally important. Like, what's important to the players is the situation that they found themselves in, but I also knew that they would just literally never find out the full story of how things got this way. But I had the idea that there was a cataclysmic event at some point. And I've always had, I mean, as evidenced by the Minds of Metal and Wheels campaign part 2, like I have this fascination with time. And I've always thought there's this neat idea that a cataclysm, like a nuclear bomb or a nuclear war, something like that could fuck up the fourth dimension as well. And I don't know who said it. I feel like I'm about to attribute it to the wrong person by saying like I know Stephen King has said it, but he was just quoting someone like Carl Sagan. But the quote is something like, "Time is nature's way of making sure that everything doesn't happen at once." And it's actually kind of appropriate to talk about this in 2020 because with everybody like locked down at home because of coronavirus, I know lots of people have been talking about how their sense of time has gotten really weird, you know, like a week can feel like it, like years. I know when the US election was going on and it took like a week for them to declare a winner, man, that felt like it went on for a decade, but it was just like 5 days. So I always have this fascination with not just time, but like our perception of time. And
I actually just want to highlight, we've talked about my setting Shards of Olympus in the past, and that is also, in that setting, I had made it so that the Cataclysm had basically destabilized, like, space. Like, no, you couldn't map the world anymore. It was always shifting, and, like, reality had been destabilized that way.
Yeah, and I kind of do the inverse of it, where the map stays the same, but like the point in the timeline where players end up might vary greatly. And I even sort of imply that maybe there is also like a dimensional factor, like alternate, you know, like the many worlds theory, like dimensions overlapping on top of each other as a result of a big cataclysmic event somewhere in the past. And that is also why the players can't remember anything. It's because their sense of time is completely scrambled. And like at this point, they're driving through a prehistoric part of the timeline. So like, what are their memories even? It starts to get all jumbled in their heads as their perception of time gets more and more warped by these weird things that are happening around them. But the map remains the same. So, you know, they're in prehistoric Seattle at this point. And that at least gave them a way to get themselves to passage and find their way around. I didn't want to make it like a total labyrinth for them where they just can't get anywhere because they can't follow any map they find. They just spent all this time in the university library tracking down maps. I didn't want all that to go to waste, after all. But
I don't know. In Shards of Olympus, I can just have, you know, depending how close I want you to be to the next major narrative development, you can have a random encounter, or you can just walk to the next narrative development.
I mean, I could certainly cheat in that way. But something else I've been talking about is how...
Who are you calling a cheat?
I'm calling you a cheat, Tom. You,
not me.
Something else I've been talking about though is I liked for this one using a lot of real world locations, a lot of just
get that when you do post-apocalypse, it's always fun to take the map and be like, "Ooh, I'm gonna put this here."
Exactly. Well, and like they do it in like Fallout 3 and stuff where you can find online, people have like overlaid the maps from the Fallout games onto the real world to trace it all. And I know I think they do that in like Assassin's Creed games as well, at least some of the first ones where like, you know, you can really get a sense of the city
with the new Watch Dogs with London.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to do something similar. And in fact, the encounters they have on this adventure kind of reflect that. But so that's sort of what's going on. That's and I should also say around this time is this is we make a lot of references to things on this show. This is going to be one of the more far out ones that I've ever pulled out of my pocket. But the Will Ferrell movie of Land of the Lost.
But you love that one. I'm not surprised to hear it coming up, especially in this context.
Yeah, so in particular, they go into this like alternate dimension in Land of the Lost, and there are so many cool pieces of imagery where like they're standing in a desert, but the desert is just littered with famous landmarks from around the world, like the Eiffel Tower and a casino from Las Vegas and like a Ferris wheel and maybe the Titanic is like, you know, off in the distance. And so I wanted to kind of evoke that weird kind of mishmash imagery too, where, you know, you're in the city, but suddenly there's dinosaurs there. There are dinosaurs in Land of the Lost as well, I should add.
There's Slee Stacks, too. I think that's the original, you know, the original Land of the Lost is where Slee Stacks are from.
That's right, Slee Stacks, which I guess are kind of, now that I think about it, I guess I was taking a lot of inspiration because the Slods are kind of the Slee Stacks in a way. Ooh. These sort of frog-like monsters. I do like Land of the Lost. I like the original Croft Brothers series as well, I might add. So that's
like
sort of
Sleestacks.
Yeah, that's sort of the feeling I was going for, is I wanted it to be like a really weird kind of mashup apocalypse where all dimensions, alternate dimensions, the fourth dimension have all gone haywire.
Had you seen Land of the Lost when you did this campaign?
Yes, but you know what? It had been a couple of years since that movie came out. So now that we're talking about it, I'm realizing that I think I subconsciously took a lot more inspiration from it than I was intending to.
Like me and the side scrolling beat 'em ups.
Yeah, exactly that. But that's what I was kind of going for. Like another great part of that movie, which, you know, people are going to, if anybody listening to this has seen the Land of the Lost movie, they're going to think I'm crazy for liking it. I rewatched it earlier this year and I was like, oh my God, what the hell is this? It's insane. The reason I like it though, is it's like, it's doing something. It is committing to its bit, whatever that is. But something I really liked in that is where all the characters are just chilling at this rundown motel. But again, it's just in the middle of this weird desert. So I wanted to evoke that idea of like kitschy modern reality in the middle of a primal feeling landscape. So with all that in mind, and I also wanted to start playing around with the idea that like their brains are scrambled and maybe hinting at the idea that the characters could potentially have some degree of premonition if they really like sort their thoughts out. But I never fully committed to that idea. I just basically wanted to make it all seem very surreal. So after their brief encounter with the dinosaur at the end of the last adventure, I started this one by focusing on Beulah, who hadn't, she'd done a bit, but at this point she had never really gotten the spotlight. So I started by putting the focus on Beulah and role-playing her through a very surreal scenario that I would eventually reveal to be a dream that she was having as she had fallen asleep in the back of their vehicle as they were sort of creeping through the jungle. And the scenario I described is one where she found herself standing alone in this desert location in front of a gigantic cowboy hat and a pair of gigantic cowboy boots that like tower over top of her. They're like 20 feet tall. And just, I had, you know, I played it all straight. Cecily, who played Beulah, clued in pretty quickly that her character was having a dream because none of the other characters were there. And I had it that she could hear some crackling music on the radio, some doo-wop music. And she like walked towards the giant cowboy hat and crawled underneath. And underneath it's pitch black. And that's when I had her sort of wake up as the car bumped over a log that had crossed that was fallen across the path they were on, because it was no longer like fully a road. And so she awakes with a start. Everybody is sort of, you know, looking a bit frayed because they didn't really sleep the previous night. They're slowly progressing through this weird landscape. No sign of any other dinosaurs. And I have in my notes here, right at the top, I put, one of the nerds is going to die this adventure. And so I created a few scenarios where one of the nerds was going to die, but I was going to allow the players to have a bit of control over what was happening.
This is like those Walking Dead Telltale games.
Yeah,
someone's going to die. You get to decide who, but
you get to have some say in the call. So they pass.
But one of the nerds had been shot, right?
Yeah, Thomas was bleeding, but he was not dead. And
I'd want him to be the one that died, because otherwise we got one that's bleeding out and then one dies.
it It's going to be Thomas because he is impaired by his wound.
That makes sense.
So they pass through the jungle, the jungle section without...
It reminds me of Oregon Trail. You know Oregon Trail?
Like I love Oregon Trail,
but it's zombies.
I've beaten Oregon Trail so many times. I love that game.
It's good.
They pass through the jungle portion without any further encounter. They're going very slowly, trying to be quiet. And they come out the other side, and it's back into the apocalyptic, overgrown city. I have some description here where I talk about missing person signs, boarded up windows, patches of scorched ground, overgrown by weeds, charred corpses hanging by their feet from a rooftop, an overturned car crashed into a streetlight, the aftermath of prolonged chaos. A skeleton in tattered rags holds a faded cardboard sign. You can't read what it says anymore. And so they're driving ahead, and there's a storefront, like one of those ground level storefronts that has, you know, small apartments over top, except the whole storefront has sort of been caved inwards, and there's some food scattered out on the ground. And so they're running a bit low on food. They've just been eating all the Fritos that Rosa took from a vending machine. And so they pull
stale
up
donuts
and donuts. That's true. They didn't take any of the donuts with them, though. They just ate them. They pull up in front of
the nerds had like armsfuls of stale donuts.
I guess they did, didn't they? Well, they ate the donuts. They stopped for some more food. And as they do so, out of the darkness of this sort of hollowed out storefront comes a giant trapdoor spider. And so they have some brief like skirmish combat with the spider, and the spider in particular goes after the people in the cab of their vehicle. And so it keeps knocking the vehicle back and forth, and they manage, you know, they shoot at it. They manage to push it back into its little cavernous abode. But at the end result of that encounter is there's a rupture in their gas tank, and the car is bleeding out gas really quickly. And so they decide that, you know, we got to find some source of gas. And in the silence following that encounter, I had them all roll listen checks, and Beulah starts hearing some crackling radio doo-wop music, very similar to the stuff she heard in her dream. And, so they carefully follow the sound of the music, and they round a corner, and there is a normal strip of pavement. Everything is intact, more than intact, pristine, not overgrown. And on that pavement is a 1950s novelty gas station shaped like a giant cowboy hat and boots. And this is a real place that exists. I'm sending you a link right now to the Hat and Boots gas station. It was a place that opened in 1953 in Seattle. It is a gas station under a giant cowboy hat, and the cowboy boots are actually men's and women's washrooms are inside of them. And the reason I wanted to specify, like, we're talking about the 50s version of this place, because later on in its life, the Hat and Boots were just repurposed into a playground. And I think they've completely been torn down now. What a weird roadside attraction. I got a real soft spot for weird roadside attractions like that. But, you know, this thing, this weird gas station in the middle of post-apocalyptic overgrown landscape, there's that Land of the Lost imagery that I was going for. A weird mix of tacky and surreal and post-apocalyptic. So they pull up to the gas station, and the place is like untouched. Beulah gets out of the back of the El Camino and tries the pumps, and they have gas. And they're at a gas station, so they realize, like, okay, we can fix our car here. Absolutely. And everybody clambers out. The nerds stick together, and Rosa stays with the nerds. And she, since she's the smart hero, is trying to help Thomas with his wound using her, what's the D? It's a heel check, but I'm trying to remember what the D20 modern equivalent is. But heel check, like medical check.
Medicine?
Sorry?
Medicine?
Medicine, yeah. So she and the nerds stick together and try to heal up Thomas. Everybody else spreads out and goes into the gas station. I believe Ralph and Critter and Doc decide to check out the boots, and Sadie and Beulah go into the gas station. That's everybody. Yeah. So they don't this time they don't have to roll any of those scavenging post-apocalypse checks because the building is totally intact. Sadie and Beulah go into the gas station and they find everything they need to like patch the gas tank. They find some empty like jerry cans that they go out and they fill those up with gas. And Beulah finds the radio. It's just like a little transistor radio that is playing this music. And she starts fiddling with the knob. And as she does so, she comes across a broadcast with a human voice. And it's clearly like a pre-recorded one. And it's reading out a series of numbers.
Kenny's just like going through all this 50s gas station snacks. And he's like, these snacks all taste like old person snacks.
But still eating them all, I'm assuming.
Well, he tries one from each.
Ugh. Blah, blah. So Beulah hurriedly like notes down the numbers, but it's pretty clear that this message is just repeating over and over. And so she goes back outside. Critter and Ralph and Doc start investigating the boots. They like throw open the door of one, weapons at the ready, and they just see like toilet stalls inside. And so they go in and they wash up. There's running water and it's clean. So they wash their faces. They wash up as best they can with that. And Doc steps outside first and he notices like a little bit of movement just out of the corner of his eye. And he starts following it. And it's an animal of some kind. And Steve, who's playing Doc, just got really interested in this. So I was like, all right, yeah, let's run with this. And he starts pursuing this animal through like the nearby underbrush and he catches it. And the best way I can describe it is it's a scorpion rat. It's a rat with a scorpion tail and sort of mixed in amongst its fur. It has a chitinous kind of hide. And so he manages to catch this scorpion rat, which is more scared than aggressive. And he's the dedicated hero, so he uses animal handling and calms it down. And this quickly becomes Doc's pet. I don't have it in my notes what he named it, but I'm pretty sure in my notes for one of the later sessions, I at least mention it. Scorpion. But yeah, his pet scorpion rat is now scorpion. A part of the gang.
Scorpion.
Scorpirat.
Scorpion.
So what I like to do is when my party has willingly divided like this to investigate an area, that's when I have the shit go down. And so as they are all doing this, I have them all roll spot and listen checks, you know, perception checks. And I can't remember who noticed it, but someone hears an approaching vehicle. So everybody hides immediately. And a big pickup truck with three Omega boys pulls up to the gas station. And in the bed of the truck, they have a cage containing three, like, basically mutant dogs. Did you ever see the Ang Lee version of the Hulk?
Yeah.
You know, those mutant dogs, like the Hulk dogs? I wanted those in my adventure, basically. In particular, the mutant poodle, because what a hilarious image. And so the Omega boys dismount. One of them starts filling up the truck with the gas. The dogs in the back are barking like crazy. And so the second Omega boy yells at the third. He's like, just get them out and take them like for a walk, or maybe they got to do their business or something. And so he gets out and he's got these three dogs straining on a big leather leash, and they start like sniffing around the area, obviously headed towards the group who are hiding by the boots. And so this is where things like where shit goes down. Basically, they find Critter and Doc and Ralph. The dogs go crazy. Combat ensues. Beulah and Sadie, and I guess Kenny, have the drop on them because they're hiding inside the gas station. I should also note the nerds and Rosa got into the cab of their car when they heard the truck going to hide. But combat ensues, and in a bid to like distract the Omega Boys, lead them away from where Beulah and Sadie are hiding, Thomas gets out and goes like, "Hey, over here." And he is tragically just gunned down where he stood. Everybody was really upset by this. And at this point, like one of the rules that I try to have is like, you know, for this setting is like, make it higher stakes. Things can always get worse. And so another joy buzzer storm starts to kick up. The wind is picking up. Rain is starting to fall. And I had it in my notes. I was like, after three rounds of combat, the ball lightning starts. And so that's exactly what went down. Ran three rounds of combat. You know, people are ducking and dodging, bullet fire. There are some injuries. There's been one death so far. And then the ball lightning starts. And after a few close calls, the ball lightning completely explodes the Omega Boys vehicle. Even though two of them have gotten out as well as the dogs, it takes one of the Omega Boys out with it. And the players just sort of fight until their enemies are subdued, and they patch up their vehicle. They hide from the storm. They hide under the big cowboy hat for the remainder of the storm. And they patch up their vehicle and they get in. And Beulah asks Rosa if she knows, you know, what the numbers on the radio mean. And with some intelligence checks, Rosa discovers like, oh, these are latitude and longitude coordinates, and the location seems closer than where they had been told passage would be, but it's like on their way in the direction they're heading. And so they decide, okay, we're going to go to these coordinates next. And that is where the adventure concluded.
So what happened was after Tom died, right when the joy buzzer storm was starting, Kenny ran out and grabbed one of the nozzles for the gas and tried to spray it at an Omega Boy's face, but it just kind of like helplessly like poured out of the nozzle instead. And he was like, uh-oh. And then the lightning bolt hit the truck and exploded, and then the gasoline caught on fire, and he burns to death from gasoline in a second episode in a row.
I was thinking he grabs the nozzle thinking he's going to use it like a flamethrower, but the wind is too great, so he pulls the trigger and the gas just blows back all over him.
I mean, yeah, basically. Like, what I was thinking is for some reason he thinks it's going to be like a squirt gun and he's going to shoot it in the eyes of the Omega Boy. But it just like, blah, 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 yeah. And just like creates a flammable puddle at his feet.
Ah, poor Kenny. But hey, you know, now that you know that there's sort of like a dimensional temporal element to this, his resurrection, you could even work that into the story. Every time
he just has bad luck with gasoline these two sessions.
Every time the party turns their back, he dies, but then suddenly he's there again, and it doesn't seem weird. It's almost like he was always there.
Tavern time! It's tavern time.
It is the tavern time.
Did you bring anything for tavern time?
Well, I knew what you wanted to cover and figured that would probably take the spotlight. So I did bring one thing. It's real short.
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm always on the lookout for ridiculous D&D monsters. I've talked about a number of them on this show in the past, but I found one that I hadn't heard of before. I'm going to send you this picture. It is the Owlephant.
This all seems like good product to me.
It's an elephant, but it's got like the face of an owl, but it's still got a trunk and tusks, and then like a centaur almost out of the front of the elephant's body, it has the two owl talons. This massive creature looks like an elephant with the head of a giant owl. Beneath its tusks, two clawed arms protrude from its body, one to each side of its elephantine trunk. Its feathered owl head is dark brown, fading to gray as it blends into its elephant-like body. This is from...
It legitimately looks so much cooler than an elephant. Like, this looks badass.
I mean, it's pretty wild, right? Like, I'd love to ride one, have a character riding one. And of course, it's actually pretty great. It's got an AC of 16, it's got 95 hit points, and then it has multiple attacks. It can slam, it can attack with its talons, and it can gore you with its tusks, and it can even trample you.
This would be a fantastic pickup for anybody with polymorph.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, that would actually be really good. Challenge rating of 8. It's a huge magical beast. It's got dark vision, low light vision. It's got a plus 18 to perception. I guess that's the owl in it is just really awesome and perceptive. I'm looking at it now and I realize somehow it has a plus 1 to stealth. I can't explain that. How do you hide this thing? It's like a literal elephant in the room.
I'm also wondering, like, magic beast, I wonder if that would be classified as a monstrosity now, because I think owl bears are monstrosities, so you can't regular polymorph into them.
Magical beast, similar to animals, but with intelligence scores higher than 2. They have supernatural or extraordinary abilities, but sometimes merely bizarre in appearance or habits. I think maybe you could polymorph something into it.
I just think that, like, if you can't polymorph into an owl bear in 5e terms...
Yeah, why an owl?
You probably can't polymorph into this. But you could true polymorph. But then at that point, why aren't you turning a vampire or an undead into a banana stand?
Ooh, good callback. I like that. Anyway, so... I just wanted to share the brilliance of the Owlephant. And like you said, like, it looks a lot cooler than it sounds. I encourage, this will be on our WordPress, of course, but people can also look up the Owlephant to see all of its stats. And I think it's pretty neat. It would sure be fun to spring that on some players who had never even heard of it.
Also, like, man... Like, if I brought back the screech owls and they show up riding
elephants.
Yeah,
and they ride elephants as their, like, land mounts.
And their, like, trunk screech is, like, deafening. And, oh, my God, that'd be crazy.
Yeah, you know, they really missed a trick in these stats by not having some kind of, like, deafening horn, you know, resounding bellow from the trunk. What does the elephant screech sound like?
It has to be a screech elephant.
A screech. Anyway, so I wanted to share the elephant. I don't really have anything beyond that, but I thought it was pretty darn great. I was searching for dumb D&D monsters, and I found this one. I'm like, this isn't actually that stupid. It's pretty wild.
This is dope. Well, just like in my session, we revisited the city of Austin. I had pitched the idea that we might revisit my idea of Bloodshot Panopticon.
Yes, indeed. Care to give the listeners like a short pitch for it?
Well, I kind of thought basically what we'd do here is I would pitch it as if you were a player being introduced to the setting, basically, because the exercise here is going to be, what character would you make for this setting?
I do have an idea for a character.
So let's say, like, is your character designed such that, like, I guess, can you tell me a bit about your character, like what the basic concept is?
Sure. And I don't know if this is what you were looking for, but I also had like some ideas for story elements or plot elements, stories Absolutely. That could be built around this. So the idea behind Bloodshot Panopticon is that it's like a Soviet installation where vampires are basically trying to get their thralls or some volunteers, as I understand it, to manufacture amazing weapons for them, right?
Yeah, it's a Soviet weapons facility that is run by vampires from which there is no escape.
Yeah, it's like a prison, and then the reward if you create an amazing weapon is you're made a vampire, right?
Theoretically.
So
it's like the reward for being a familiar in what we do in the shadows is becoming a vampire.
Theoretically, yeah, exactly.
Or being a goat, you become a witch eventually.
So my character, I have him as this Russian guy. I've named him just Vitaly. And the inspiration I took for this guy, you ever seen the movie Minority Report?
Yep.
Peter Stormare plays a character in that where he's like a black market doctor who gives Tom Cruise's character an eyeball transplant. And that was kind of the idea I had behind sort of the personality, but I wanted to make him a bit more of a mad genius inventor. Cause you know, like doctor doesn't so much work in this case. I wanted him to be actively working on the project. And, so he, Vitaly is like, he likes to drink. He's very vice ridden. I would have it be that like anything he can get his hands on, you know, like those guys who would drink like jet fuel to get drunk during the war. That's the kind of guy he is.
So could I maybe take over now and we'll go to my side and I'll do some introduction for Vitaly?
Yeah, do it.
So Vitaly, you know, he's always been kind of, especially with the strictures of the Soviet Union, he's always had to keep like one foot on one side of the law at all times. He's got to have friends in high places, but he's also got to get materials and whatnot. And so he's been soliciting grave robbers, you know, like he needs bodies or something like that. But one of these things, you know, one of these illicit dealings of his has caught up with him. And then in the night, he is taken. And then he wakes up and he's in like a cell and he doesn't know, like he tries asking for information or something, but nobody's answering him and he's being fed and stuff. But he slowly realizes that he is under the effects of some sort of addiction because he has studied it enough and experienced it enough. And it's not like he's being given his normal vices, like he's being given alcohol with his rations maybe or something, but he becomes aware that there is something that he is like not getting, and the revelation once he is desperate for it will be that what he needs is the vampire blood vitae.
Interesting. I like it. So the plot setup that I the storyline idea I kind of had for Vitaly was this was one that was inspired by I was trying to think, you know, because of these kinds of scenarios. I was reminded of stuff like Aperture Science or SCP is another sort of idea. These facilities. I'm also playing the video game Control, and the Federal Bureau of Control has that sort of ominous facility that you can't quite escape.
I mean, it's the prisoner, too. Like,
yeah, the prisoner, of course.
It's all appropriate.
But the thinking of Aperture Science really stuck with me, and I was reminded of the short film Portal No Escape. Did you ever see that short film?
Yeah, but it's been a long time.
I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It's just Chell escaping from Aperture using the portal gun. But I liked the idea. I like that sort of just that kind of feeling of like Vitaly invents a gun. He invents a weapon, like a really powerful weapon, and quickly realizes that he could use it to fight his way out just as easily as his keepers could use it for their own purposes. And so I envisioned a plot line where he tries to escape and probably fails, of course, but he doesn't fail because the authorities get their hands on his weapon that he's created, but instead someone else, a different prisoner, gets their hands on his weapons. And so it becomes this thing where everybody's a MacGuffin. Everybody's trying to get the MacGuffin that is this uber powerful weapon and either use it to get in with the authorities and be made into a vampire, or use it for their own purposes, use it to take over the facility, use it to escape. And I hadn't really thought of what the exact weapon was, because at that point I had sort of gotten stuck on a lot of stuff we'd seen before, like a gravity gun from Half-Life, that kind of thing. But I liked the idea of Vitaly succeeds in doing what he's been brought there for, but he doesn't want to hand it over, and having it be this like object of desire for everybody who comes across it. Even, you know, at some point, if the vampires in charge get their hands on it, it could be that it causes like a schism between them where none of them want to give it up. They all want it just each for their own purposes.
So where my mind immediately goes with this, particularly with the idea of like Vitaly having this like desperate attempt at escape, is one of the early, like one of the earliest episodes of The Prisoner is one in which the main character believes that he is escaping, and in actuality, it's all just been like, you know, it's just the village is fucking with him. Like his whole experience of getting away and meeting other contacts and everything is just staged so that they can observe his like theoretical escape. And I think that that's exactly what would happen with Vitaly, is that he'd believe he was escaping, and we'd run this campaign where like you are trying to escape with the weapon and there is the MacGuffin thing. But then at the end, it's just like slow clap and the curtains come down and the vampires are like, your weapon is quite impressive after all. And that would probably be the crushing moment where they offer him the chance to become a vampire. I actually also want to cover, so like in New World of Darkness, there's the system of like, so would Vitaly be primarily a physical, mental or social character? What would his like main strengths be?
I would say primarily a mental character. And what even if he's mentally unstable.
Be? Right. And what would his weakness be?
Vices, right?
So would you say that would be like, I'm thinking more weakness, like if you go intelligence is his strength, then it would would physical or social be his downfall?
Basically? Physical would absolutely be his downfall. It would be something like he's abused his body for too long, and as a result, like he's quite weakened. His strengths are all in being able to talk to people and his immense knowledge.
So I think initially the disciplines, like the vampiric abilities, even while he's just a ghoul, his vampiric abilities, the first ones that would be offered to him would be like physical ones. And so it's funny, this is like the classic, like, again, we've talked about like, I know you haven't played a lot of Pokemon, but you know, Pokemon has the classic RPG structure of like, do you want to be a wizard? a thief or a warrior. It's like, do you want a fire Pokemon, a water Pokemon, or a grass Pokemon to start with? Does Vitali want blood-infused strength, vigor? Does he want blood-infused speed, celerity, or blood-infused toughness, resilience?
I'd go for celerity, probably speed.
That would probably, like, the most obvious thing was that it could speed up his work and he could, like, yeah, quickly put things together and then, like, you know, quickly get out of trouble. And then I guess from there, what I'd be interested in is, like, I guess specifically what sort of clan you would see Vitali fitting into, and then what other, like, cool vampiric powers you would, like, you as a player would want Vitali to eventually gain. So for the clans, I can break it down simply. There's Nosferatu, they're the scary ones. There's Meket, they're the sneaky, shadowy ones. There is Deva, they're the sexy ones. There's Ventru, they are the lordly, domineering ones. And there's Gangrel, which are the, like, bestial ones.
You know, like, I'm kind of torn because it would be... It's tough to say because on the one hand, I feel like it would be neat to have him, you know, become a vampire and basically turn around his weaknesses. He, you know, become part of the clan that are the lordly ones and sort of ascend to, like, higher society. And his vampiric powers are, like, bolstering his constitution, making him stronger, filling in the gaps. But at the same time, I think it might actually be more fun if he just goes straight Nosferatu and become even sort of more ghoulish and withdraw even more to the point where now he has this monstrous appearance and he has to, like, hide in the shadows and, the is there a name for, like, the authority vampires?
I mean, in cities, in the lore of vampire, there's typically, like, a specific hierarchy. Like, there's the prince of the city and whatnot.
Specifically, in Bloodshot Panopticon, the vampires running the facility.
Yeah, I mean, I just call them, like, the lords of the facility or something. Like, that's what I was just getting at, is, like, there are generic terms that they use for, like, city positions, and I'd probably use some version of that. Like, I'd probably make it Soviet, so there's, like, commissars or something.
Yeah, so the commissars, you know, they're impressed with his...
The ministers, actually. It would definitely be ministers because of 1984.
Sure. The ministers, then. They're impressed with what he's been able to do, but his attempt at escaping and his obviously kind of, like, flawed personality, it's like, as punishment for that, they're like, yeah, okay, we'll make you a vampire, but you're going to be, like, this hideous ghoul that... They keep him in solitary confinement in a dark corner and make him toil away at producing more weaponry and more inventions for them. So I almost think that would be more interesting.
You say that, but if he gets turned into a Nosferatu, that means there was a Nosferatu to turn him. And it sounds like if in that situation, he'd have at least one ally who's in the same position, although that person would obviously try to manipulate him as well. I thought it was interesting that you said Ventru, because in my experience, Ventru do tend to be the ones that are like have major personal flaws and stuff, like addictions and stuff. I ran a Ventru who was very much like he was an addict in life. And then in New World of Darkness, like, so in Old World of Darkness, there's the clan that their curse is that they're insane, the Malkavians. And in New World of Darkness, they were made into a bloodline for the Ventru called the Malkovians. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, it's really interesting to me that there is a precedent of, like, oh, yeah, the most powerful ones, they are the most fucked up, like, deep down. And so he would get to that position and realize that, like, everybody else in that position is just as messed up as he is, if not more. And, like, he's probably going to see more of deterioration even as he tries to, like, compensate for it with his abilities. I was a bit surprised. I thought you might jump at the Mechet a bit, given his sort of, like, the need for secrecy and sort of rebellion in his situation. But also the Nosferatu idea that you pitched, I liked a lot, because it reminds me of how, like, that prisoner plot, there is a similar idea in Game of Thrones, where they pretend to let, spoiler alert, they pretend to let Theon Greyjoy escape, but it's all a trick. And this is, like, what turns, like, this kind of manipulation is what turns him into Reek.
Yeah,
like, this
exactly.
would be basically Vitaly becoming the Reek. But with, you know, that this is the whole thing, is that there would be another bigger Reek that you could always, like, well, like, like, there's always that element of, like, even though you are below the ministers, when you become one of them, you are being brought, like, whether they like it or not, into one of their clans. And that gives you a certain level of, like, can I trust on that? Can I?
Yeah, and I mean, because of that, he would be still above all of the sort of weakling humans that are being brought into this facility. And so it could, you know, there could be another plot where after this all goes down, he gets assigned to oversee one particular part of the facility or a particularly promising new subject that they've brought in. And, you know, that could be interesting as well, where he has to just, you know, he has to be the keeper of someone who is like what he used to be.
And no matter who ends up siring him as a vampire, that person is definitely going to have his own plans for what this means. Like, okay, I'm going to make a new vampire, but they're going to owe me because I made them. And, like, what they intend for this new vampire to represent in the system. So then the last thing I wanted to cover was just, like, any cool vampire powers you'd like to see Vitaly picking up at some point. The ability to control animals, the ability to turn into animals, the ability to turn invisible or wipe minds, or
I was definitely
scare a Nosferatu at its highest level can literally scare a person to death.
Scaring people would be pretty fun, but I was definitely thinking, like, a lot of the mental abilities, like mind wiping or, you know, mesmerism, things like that.
Nosferatu also get access, similar to the Mechets, they get access to, like, stealth abilities, like invisibility. And that, one of the sort of offshoots of that ability is one you can get called the Familiar Stranger, where basically, as long as you know basically who someone is planning to meet with, you can appear as that person.
Perfect. That's exactly that kind of thing. Powers of manipulation, I think more than anything, would befit his character.
It'd also be interesting to see him, like, end up doing, like, side quests and stuff for vampires in other clans in the hopes that they would teach him some unique discipline that he needed access to. Like, that's a way that you can get access to things that your clan doesn't normally have access to. But of course, to get taught a discipline by a vampire, you need, like, you owe them big time. Like, they'll make you work a long time to pay that off.
I like it.
So, yeah. Welcome to the Bloodshot Panopticon, Vitaly.
And of course, he'd become addicted, like, he'd drink too much blood. He'd be addicted to feeding even when it wasn't necessary.
In New World of Darkness, you pick your vice and virtue. So his vice would definitely be gluttony.
Yeah, absolutely. And he'd keep getting into trouble because
his virtue would probably be hope if he thought he could get out.
Yeah.
Unless they crushed that out of him.
he'd keep getting assigned to like oversee promising inventors, but then, you know, his bloodlust would overcome him and he'd kill them, and then you get in trouble with the ministers.
But then, of course, if another vampire feeds him their blood, he'll get addicted to them specifically, and he can be enthralled while he's a vampire. So someone could use that, you know, that vice against him.
Seems likely to happen to him.
Anyway, so yeah, that's very cool. That was awesome to talk about. This has been another episode of Compare and Campaign. If you want to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me on Twitter at Narnog, NAR_NOG. Talk to Tom Lando. Otherwise, you can talk to us on Facebook. Follow us on Facebook, Compare and Campaign on Facebook. And finally, you can check out our oh-so-precious show notes, supplemental materials, the map of Drail, all this cool stuff, a picture of an elephant, a picture of the front of the hats and boots, get some magic words, all that stuff. That'll be on our WordPress, compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. McGill, you got to hit me up one of these days so we can fill that in, because I haven't gotten a message from you asking for my magic words list yet.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I gotta update that. It's been a busy time.
No worries. No, I get it. I understand. But yeah, sooner or later, it's all going to be up there. In the meantime...
Level up your characters?
Not me. What is the thing I said not me about earlier? That was good. Oh, who are you calling a cheat? Not me.